Hi there, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Moderate Party, a political podcast for moderate centrists and independents. As always, I'm your host, Hillary Lombard. And I'm really excited about this episode because earlier this month, I had the privilege of attending the 2024 Ideas Summit in Phoenix, Arizona, hosted by the New Deal Forum. It was a really cool event. It's a place where policymakers and thought leaders from across the country can get together to discuss pressing issues facing our country. Against the backdrop of discussions around climate change and the future of education in America, the summit also highlighted the urgent need for collaborative solutions in an increasingly polarized political landscape, which you know was an automatic green flag for me. At the summit, I had the privilege of sitting down with Arizona Representative Laura Tarrick, an influential figure in Arizona state politics. Representative Tarrick has been on my radar for a while, so when I knew that I was going to be attending this event and I saw her name on the roster, I knew I had to get her on the show so that you guys could hear from her. Laura's leadership roles and her involvement in key initiatives have demonstrated her commitment to driving meaningful change in Arizona. From securing water supplies for communities like the Rio Verde foothills to negotiating vital reforms for election recount laws, something we all know is important in Arizona, Representative Tarrick's work exemplifies the pragmatic approach that is needed to address these states' pressing issues. But it's not all good. We also dive into the challenges of being a moderate in public office and the factors that motivated a successful freshman representative not to seek re-election. It's a vulnerable and thought-provoking conversation, and I hope that you all enjoy it as much as I did. One final note before we dive in, when we recorded this episode, the Arizona Supreme Court had just announced their decision to uphold that 1864 abortion ban. Thankfully, since we've recorded it, the Arizona State House passed a bill to repeal the ban. We're not out of the woods yet. The issue now moves to the Arizona State Senate, which is also expected to repeal the ban. But until they do, make sure that you keep your eyes and your attention on Arizona. Now, without any further ado, I'm Hillary Lombard, and this is Moderate Party. Let's get started. All right, so we are officially recording.
Okay.
Let's just start with, did you grow up in Arizona?
I did, yes.
What was that like?
I'm a proud product of Arizona public schools. I went K-12 here, and then I got my undergraduate degree from the University of Arizona, and then my master's degree in education from Arizona State University. So I joke that I just need the PhD from Northern Arizona University, and then I will have covered the entire state. The desert is a huge part of who I am. I also went to graduate school in New York, and when I was away, it was like a physical, I didn't feel quite myself without being in the desert. And so I love it here. And I could have never imagined that I would now be in the position that I'm in serving this state.
What characteristics would you associate with people from Arizona?
I think we're very friendly and very relaxed. And certainly the heat is a unique, we talk about that wherever we go.
In Sacramento, it gets pretty hot in the summer. And I look to Arizona for perspective.
Yes.
So yeah. That I can just grow up and be a big girl. I'm like, at least it's not 120.
Yeah, it gets rough, but well, beautiful place.
I've started to treat the summers the way that people of old used to treat the winters. Like, I'm like, you mustn't go outside. Like, people die out there. And that's when I catch up on all my movies and then become active in the winter.
Okay, jokes aside. Before you were in the legislature, you were a kindergarten teacher for a Title I school. How do you think that prepared you for office?
It has honestly served me so well down there. They joke at the Capitol that I have kindergarten teacher energy, but truly, I'm very patient, patience for days, and I just don't take the bait. Sometimes my colleagues across the aisle will tweet at me or what have you, and I never respond. You know, we have heated conversations sometimes, and I'm just very measured and very focused on the work that we need to do at hand, and it has really served me well down there.
What made you take the leap from being a teacher to running for office?
Yeah, so I was teaching kindergarten, and I had my 36 kids sitting on the rug in front of me, which is too many for a single classroom.
Yeah.
And it was the morning, getting going on our reading, and I was, you know, reading them a story, and I heard this terrible crack from above. And I looked up at the ceiling, and I just thought, oh my gosh, that's coming down. And sure enough, it was.
The ceiling.
The ceiling. So the ceiling collapsed over my kids as I was teaching, and thankfully I was able to jump up and shield the kids, so I was the only one injured, but this is the state of education in Arizona. And then I was still in the classroom when the state stopped funding full-day kinder. And I saw what a difference that made for my students, especially in a Title I school district. Many of them have not had the benefit of going to pre-K, which that early childhood piece is so important for our kiddos. And they really need that educational time to set themselves up for success. It's the foundation of their education. And I remember reading at the time, there was a state lawmaker who said, it doesn't really matter because kindergarten is just babysitting anyway. And I called that gentleman's office and I said, I would love for him to come and see our classroom and spend the day with us so that you can see how important this work really is. And of course, I never heard back from him, but I thought, all right, if you're not going to come to my house and take care of my kids, then I'm going to go to your house and change the laws.
It's a pretty badass answer, Laura. I'm not going to lie to you. Wow. Okay. So there's a lot there.
Yeah.
Pardon my ignorance, but is full day kindergarten normal?
I'm actually not sure. That's a great question. But Governor Janet Napolitano instituted that in Arizona, and then it was overturned by Governor Jan Brewer a number of years later. Many districts still offer it because they know how popular it is and how beneficial it is, but it comes out of other areas of their budget. And in Arizona, funding for public education is really not so low. It's not where it needs to be. So we sacrifice that for other things.
And if I am correctly informed, those early childhood years are the biggest determinant of how successful you'll be later in life, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's work that I've tried to do at the Capitol is to help push good early birth to five policy and inform my colleagues about what a difference that makes, not only for our kids, and again, their long-term success, but for our workforce, for allowing, you know, predominantly women to get into the workforce. And I mean, it just ties into so many things. Productivity for companies, because parents aren't, they can depend on high quality, affordable childcare. They're not needing to miss work for things. And people who offer that care, that's so such important care for our kids, making sure that they're paid a living wage as well, since it is so crucial, that work.
And when you explain that to people, do you think that they're able to grasp it, like the importance of that birth to five?
I hope so. I recently held a forum at the Capitol, and I was so delighted. It was bipartisan. We had members from both chambers, and we had leading experts in the field of early childhood. I'm talking about exactly that, if this is such an important investment to make. And it is an investment. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that, but it pays dividends later on down the road in any number of ways.
When you actually do decide that you're going to run for office, did that come easy? Like, was it as soon as he doesn't get back to you and you're like, buddy, I'm coming? Or is it a more gradual process to get to that decision point?
For me, it was a little bit more gradual. I think some people wake up and decide that they're going to run for office one day. That wasn't necessarily the case for me. It's a huge decision. And especially women, they say women need to be asked seven times to run for office.
Seven times.
And I was asked a number of times. I was approached to run in 2020. I was asked four times. I said no three times and yes once. And it wasn't the right time, wasn't the right race. So I went to work for Representative Jennifer Pollack in her 2020 race. So I got a really good look at what it takes to campaign, especially in a purple district. And then my professional work outside of the legislature, one of my jobs, since I have several, one of my jobs is with an organization called Civic Engagement Beyond Voting, nonprofit, nonpartisan. We're focused on helping people engage with local government. So I did a lot of bill tracking, testimony work at the legislature. So I had a really good idea. I went in eyes wide open about what it takes to win and then what it takes to govern. So in 22, I decided to take the plunge, and I always felt that I would be uniquely suited for a battleground district, for a swing district. So I won. I'm a Democrat. I won in a district with a 20,000 person voter registration advantage for the Republicans.
Why did you think that you'd be uniquely suited for that?
I go back to that kindergarten teacher. I'm very focused on, here are my policies, here's my platform. This is why I'm pragmatic and focused on the work at hand. I'm low drama, I think. And I really put in the work and really do my best to listen to all of my constituents. My district is a third Republican, Democrat, independent, and I don't want any one of those groups to feel that they're not being heard, even if they don't always agree with me. And I took that message to the doors.
And what was the response?
I think our team knocked tens upon tens of thousands of doors. And so just a lot of times you'll hear from people, I haven't had anyone ever come to my door before. And I think just being there and recognizing that your local politician is a real person and is there to listen to you and may not always agree with you, but will always be available to have that dialogue, I think matters a lot to people.
Do you consider yourself a moderate?
Yes, I absolutely do consider myself a moderate. And I think that can be a challenging space to occupy sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. I even find it difficult as a podcast that is moderate to hold that space sometimes. But I'm curious what being a moderate means to you.
Arizona politics is in a hyper-polarized state. And that's true nationwide, but certainly in a battleground state like Arizona. And so I think sometimes there is a mentality on either side of if a policy comes from across the aisle, I'm going to vote no on it simply because it's not from my party. I vote yes on Republican bills all the time, and I work with Republicans all the time. I think that's another part of being a moderate is there's also the mentality of let bad policy die. Well, if we can, but if we can improve policy, we should try and work together. And I think a lot about how divided our country is and what the way forward is for that. And I think it's never going to get better unless we try to talk to each other, there are issues that we will simply never agree on. But hearing the other person's perspective and finding that common ground where you can, I think is vital work.
Does it ever get exhausting?
Every day. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. Especially there are a number of bills. Housing, I'm often voting through in a small group of Democrats, property rights, things like that. Water, sometimes I've voted on a number of election bills that sometimes you're voting in groups of one or two or three, and that's okay. That happens. And that's where it's to make sure they understand, why you're making the decisions that you're making. And also, it is really tiring.
One of the polls that I think back on all the time is when you ask people if their representative should compromise and work with the other side, they say yes, mm-hmm. until it's compromise that they don't agree with. And then suddenly they say no. So I'm curious, when you're holding that moderate space, did you find it difficult to justify that to your district, or were they receptive because they are a more purple district?
My district was receptive, but what's interesting is that there really are only a handful of purple districts in the state. And so we're unique. And we just face different challenges. And I think that, if you're in your district talking to your voters, you hear what's important to them. And if your district is very blue or very red, that's all you hear. Whereas my district is representative of, I think, a broader swath mm-hmm. of folks. And we're all sent down there to serve our voters. And sometimes that means we make decisions that are in their best interest, even if it's not always popular, but that's the hard work of governance.
So when you're running your campaign, you're uniquely suited to this district, you're knocking on doors. How's that for you emotionally? Is it a hype train that never stops or imposter syndrome? Like, where are you at when that's happening?
That's a fascinating question to answer. I always thought that we would get the seat when I was running in 22, because we had just redistricted, so it was an open seat. I always thought we would get the seat. I had a hard time picturing myself in it for some reason, just because it was something that I'd worked so hard for and that I'd wanted very much. And people always say about running for office, it's a marathon, not a sprint. I don't think I quite understood that, because the pressure, especially in a battleground, is on every single day. You don't take days off. You need to be on the phones, raising money, out at the doors, talking to voters. That's your entire job. And I remember I was driving to a canvass in October, and I looked down at my cup and I had forgotten my soda or my caffeine for the morning. And I started crying. And I was as surprised as you are. I was like, what is happening right now? And I was just so exhausted, because I was wearing down every single day and never recharging, because we'd just been going so hard for so long. But I always knew that's what it would take. And then I won, and there was hardly a moment to breathe. The election was on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, I was taking calls for the leadership vote. And on Thursday, I was at the House taking the leadership vote. So it was nonstop.
Is that just how it goes in Arizona, or is that an unusual turnaround time?
I mean, the vast majority of districts that were won in the primary, they'd had several months to decompress. Their races were essentially over in August. But for our handful of purples, buckle up.
Did you experience any kind of relief or, yes, we did it? Or were you just, that's great, next thing?
I did. I did have a minute to breathe or so. And yeah, I was very proud of myself. I was incredibly proud and grateful for our team. This is a team effort. We have incredible volunteers and supporters in our district, and I absolutely would not be sitting here without them. So I was filled with a profound amount of gratitude for that effort that went in.
So you said that you worked on a campaign before you ran one of your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, when you get to office, do you feel like your expectations were accurate, like that you had a good idea of what actually governing would be like, or was that a difficult adjustment for you?
I had a very good idea of what it would be like. I'm very proud that I was able to hit the ground running. That being said, I spent a lot of time talking to a number of my mentors about the unique environment we find ourselves in now. And I was like, I was prepared. I knew what this would be like going in, but it's worse than it's ever been. It's a very toxic place. And as prepared as I was for that going in, it surprised me even still.
The toxicity?
Yeah. And I knew this would happen, but the absolute refusal to move good policy if it comes from Democrats, particularly Democrats in competitive districts. I had a bill that I ran last year so I wanted to work on school safety. Didn't want to touch the Second Amendment at all because I'm aware of the political environment in Arizona. So I started researching states that had the lowest number of school shootings relative to population size and looking at some of their laws. And it led me to a Louisiana law, I believe, that exempts school blueprints from public records requests.
Mm.
I thought that's a really simple bill, doesn't cost anything. One more layer of safety that we can ensure our kids are protected. Got that bill through committee unanimously. It went through committee of the whole for group debate. No flags, nothing came up. And then it was put up for third read, our final vote of the entire body, put up and pulled. And at a certain point, people were saying, I've never seen a bill put up and pulled this many times. What's going on? So finally, I was sat down and told just flat out, you're a Democrat in a competitive district. We want your seat. We will not be giving you a win.
Wow.
And that's a difficult environment to work in.
Even on something that incremental, it's not mm-hmm. like there's a huge interest group of like school blueprint enthusiasts that you need to.
Right.
Wow.
I had a similar experience both last year and this year with a bill to prohibit the practice of suspending students out of school for absenteeism alone. Mm-hmm. And it's just so hard when good, simple, free policy doesn't move forward simply because of the letter next to your name and the seat that you occupy. I think Arizonans deserve better.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really disheartening. And people ask me all the time, should Democrats take control of the legislature? Or are you going to do the same thing to Republicans? And I always say no, because this state is the third Republican Dem independent. And I know what it's like to not feel that your voice is being heard at the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that to half of our state.
Like coming from California, we have a Democratic supermajority mm-hmm. and it is, it's not good for our state to just have one party with that much power because mm-hmm. it's like the Republicans are, I don't want to say that they're like furniture for the building, but it's like nobody will take meetings with them. Like their staff makes less, they have less staff. Like mm-hmm. it's very much like a caste system by party. And I think that it's like, then you have people in your state that don't feel like they have a voice and they just get progressively more and more radicalized in mm-hmm. their own silence of representation. And I think that Arizona being more of a purple state might actually have a better chance at being able to maintain representation while also having a Democrat majority. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like there are more pragmatic Democrats in Arizona. Does that seem accurate or am I naive?
I absolutely, that's the case. And certainly we've seen from the strength of the leadership of our statewide elected officials, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, who's here today, Governor Hobbs, Governor Katie Hobbs, and of course, AG Chris Mays, they've displayed exceptional leadership. And we have a outstanding crop of folks running for office in 24. And to your point, Republicans have held control of the state house since 1960.
Mm-hmm.
No one party has a monopoly on good ideas. And I hope that's something that evolves as we continue. Arizona.
Do you think that there's like reforms that could be put in place that would improve the situation, or do you think it's a cultural change that has to happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about, I've had this conversation many times with one of my colleagues across the aisle, who's a very good friend, talking about limiting the number of bills that can be brought forward from each mm-hmm. member. And that if that was done, the agreement would be that every bill is heard. So at least it has its time. People can come in and speak on its behalf, either for or against. But that way, at least you feel like, okay, this is an even playing field for ideas. Whether they would get up on the board, I don't know. But at least they would receive a committee hearing so that members of the public could come and make their voices heard.
Yeah, at least you have a shot. Do you think that there's any interest in that type of change?
I'm not sure. I mean, potentially, there are members who are very prolific, run hundreds of bills each session. I'm not sure how they would feel. And in Arizona, we have a number of deadlines. And come January, we have a 7-bill, at least in the House, a 7-bill limit. So if you don't have anything pre-filed, you only get 7 after that. And I know we all feel that crunch. So I think that would be a strange adjustment to go to, okay, you only have 7 or you only have 10 or 15. But I also think the other side of that is that it would make people very thoughtful about what they run. And surely you could put safeguards in place that if you have a support of the majority of the body or 2/3, that you could bring something forward even outside those parameters as a safeguard.
So you talked a little bit about the toxicity, mm-hmm. right? And how you struggle to get Republican support just because there's a D by your name. But then I noticed when I was preparing for this episode that you've made an effort to praise and call out your Republican colleagues that have helped you move impactful legislation across. Mm-hmm. Like you had a water bill and you praised him for his help in getting that bill across the finish line. Why?
I'm a kindergarten teacher at heart, and I think credit where credit is due. And that was Representative Alex Colladan. We worked together both last session and this session on water and elections, of all things. And he's a far-right Freedom Caucus member. But I think, and there are a number of other Republicans down there who I work very well with and who run smart, interesting policy. Again, I don't agree with everything, but I think it's important to highlight those things to show that it can be done. Even in unexpected places, I never in a million years would have thought that I would work with Representative Colladan on much of anything prior to coming to the legislature, but we work where we can.
And you never think you're going to work with him, and then you do.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen? You just knock on his door like, hey, former enemy, let's be friends.
He came to talk to me because we both sit on the elections committee together. And so we got to know each other a little bit. When you sit on committees with folks, you do get to know them. Then the Rio Verde situation happened. So Rio Verde is a community in the northern area of the city that they had been using Scottsdale water, City of Scottsdale water, for a number of years. The City of Scottsdale restricted that access and said, we're after this date, we are no longer going to provide that water. Because they're in an unincorporated area of Maricopa County, they then did not have access to any kind of, they were relying completely on either wells, their own wells, or hauled water. It's getting really expensive. We had to find some sort of solution to that. I represent part of the City of Scottsdale along with Representative Colladan, and my interest in that was making sure that my city was taken care of, because there was talk initially, okay, we're just going to force Scottsdale to send them water. And it was like, no, this is not, there has to be a different way through this. He put up a bill and it failed. It wasn't able to get the support that it needed. And I approached him afterwards and I said, I don't think your path through this is 31-9. I think it's 20-20. And for that, you're going to need a Democrat involved. So let's get to work on this. And that process was 5-6 months of meetings and drafts of that bill and going out to the community. You know, I went up to a community meeting there, and I think I was the first Democrat who had ever visited.
Mm.
I got to know the residents, and it was hard to balance all of the interests of what exactly the community wanted, but our primary goal was getting them water. And it was an interesting bill because, of course, with any issue, there's pushback and there's the kind of feeling of they bought in this area. They knew that this was coming. Why should the legislature step in? But something that Representative Colladan said that I absolutely agree with, especially moving forward, is it's good practice for the government of Arizona to ensure that everyone has water. Whether that's in our rural areas or tribal nations, that's something that all Arizona residents deserve access to. So we developed a pretty strong working relationship That way, again, we don't agree on much, but he works in good faith. And then when it came time for the election recount fix bill, we knew each other. And so much of the work down there relies on trust. Can I take you at your word? If you say you're going to do something, do you do it?
So he was also your partner on the major piece of elections legislation that you worked on?
Yes. And that, so Arizona passed a bill in 2022 that changed our recount margins. So as a result of that, we anticipate an enormous number of recounts. And because of just the timing that all of that takes, our elections departments needed additional days in their calendar. We needed to find them time. If we hadn't, and we had to vote this through by February 9th, if we didn't do that, it was going to start this cascade effect where we were potentially going to miss the deadline to send out our military and overseas ballots. And then the absolute nightmare scenario that kept me awake at night was Arizona would have missed its deadline to send our presidential votes to the Electoral College. First time in history, Arizona is a pivotal state in the election.
It's a pretty rough time to do that, too.
Yeah. A lot of people had worked on this for months prior, but the real crunch time of hammering out exactly what it's going to look like happened over a period of about 3 days. I did not eat. I did not sleep. I was subbed out of my other committees so that I could go and work on this late negotiations into the night. And finally, we arrived at something that we felt was going to work for everyone. Coming in that day, we still did not know that we had the votes. And it ended up going through with huge bipartisan support in both chambers. But the morning of, we didn't know that. And we voted it through the House and got through, went over to the Senate, and I sat up in the gallery along with Representative Colladin and our chief policy staffer for elections on the Democratic side, and then the representative from the counties. We were all up there together, and watching that bill come up on the board, I just started crying because I was so relieved and I was exhausted. Again, this is a theme apparently with me, but I was so, so relieved that we had done it and really proud of that work. Both sides give and took. I mean, it was no one's perfect bill. Mm-hmm. But it was as clean of a fix as possible, given the unique challenges of a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor.
And were you able to feel your own contributions to that achievement in real time? Or is that something that you look back in hindsight and you're like, oh, yeah, I did that thing and that was cool?
No, I felt it in real time because there were a number of moments where it looked like the deal was going to come off the table. And it was like, OK, Tarek, go back in and get this on track. And that, again, that sort of kindergarten level patience of just, okay, there's still runway here. We have done hard things before. We can do hard things again. Like, stick with this. What else can we do? And being really creative. I think that popped up in Rio Verde. And then again, with this as well, sometimes to find these good bipartisan solutions to things, you do need to think outside the box, which is an exciting challenge. And so I'm very proud of that. Glad it's over, but very proud of that effort.
That's amazing. Would you say that it's one of your greatest achievements for your time in office?
Absolutely. I will always look back on that. I can still feel what it was like sitting up in the Senate and watching that board light up green and just the sheer relief and knowing that I had done absolutely everything in my power to take care of Arizona's elections and make sure that regardless of party, that your vote is counted.
When you do these big bills and you find a partner on the other side of the aisle, do you ever get pushback from your own party?
Yeah, particularly in Rio Verde, sometimes things would come up in the press or, you know, didn't always make that process smooth. But again, you stay focused and work where you can, and that's just all you can do.
I get hate emails for this podcast, and they're bipartisan.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I think that's one of the difficult things about being a moderate is that you get it from both sides constantly. And one of the things that's more tiring is when you get it from people that are more ideologically aligned with you. Do you find that to be true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we voted on the budget last year, it was a bipartisan budget. I got a lot of pushback from my own side that we unfortunately weren't able to rein in universal vouchers or put any kind of guardrails in place, which is very unfortunate. But it's simply what we had to work with. And something that I've always said about running in occupying a position like mine is my job is to take the punches from all sides and stay standing. And someone said to me once, they said, bruises are purple.
Oh.
Okay.
I like that a lot.
Me too. Me too.
Wow. I really like that. I think on the note of fighting, you first hit my radar when I saw your response to a trans bathroom bill.
Mm-hmm. I want to speak to you now as an elected official of this state. To our trans youth, to our LGBTQ youth, I am sorry. I'm sorry you have a state legislature determined to make your lives harder. I'm sorry you have to think about legislation like this when you should be thinking about prom and college and what you're going to do after you graduate. It isn't right. And I didn't come down to the Capitol to legislate hate. So what I also want to say to you is that you do have champions down here. You do have people who will stand up for you because you are valuable and valued, and we see you. We respect you, we care about you, and we will not stop fighting for you. With that, I vote no.
I'm really curious if you've always thought of yourself as a fighter or if that's an identity that's developed for you through your time in office.
You know, it's two things can be true at once, right? I very much think of myself as a peacemaker, but I also do think of myself as a fighter. And that's one of those issues. I try to be a very calm, measured, even, thoughtful lawmaker at all times. But there are certain issues that I really go to the mat for, and that's one of them. And the reason is I know what it's like to be a vulnerable kid. And these are among our most vulnerable children. And to see the state legislature pass legislation or attempt to pass legislation that makes these kids' lives harder, I find to be unconscionable. And that's something that I will always fight for. And I wanted those kids to know those are packed rooms. Like sometimes committee, you have three lobbyists sitting in the front row and that's it. But when we hear bills like that, those tend to be packed rooms. We have members of the trans community, members of the LGBTQ community in that room and watching. And I wanted them to know that you do have people down here at the State House who are fighting for you and who really vehemently do not agree with this type of legislation.
So when you do have to go to the mat, are you comfortable there? Or is it a stretch zone for you?
It's a stretch. It's a stretch zone. And I think that it's also important to be thoughtful about when and how you do that, because I think if you're always yelling, sometimes people tune you out.
Mm-hmm.
When I get really heated about bills, it does. There was a funny incident that happened. There was a committee meeting or a caucus meeting that I was just really done with the types of elections bills that we were hearing. And I was being a little snarkier, I think, than I normally am. And every party, both sides watched the other side's caucus. And one of my colleagues across the aisle came to see me after that and was like, "Whoa, I had no idea that you thought this bill was this bad. Can we work on it?" I was like, "Okay." But if you do that all the time, it just becomes background noise. But the fact that it's rare for me, I think that it doesn't escape attention when I fight that hard, I should say, in that fight that way.
If you're Chicken Little all the time, I think you become less credible. Mm-hmm. You're just upset. You're like an upset person all the time. And I think there's such strength in being level-headed mm-hmm. on things like that. But an issue that I am not level-headed on is women's reproductive rights, like mm-hmm. everything in moderation except women's liberty and bodily autonomy. And I would be remiss not to ask you, the Arizona Supreme Court chose to uphold a abortion ban from before Arizona was even a state. Were you surprised by that ruling?
I wish I could say that I was. No, it's part of a larger trend, a disturbing trend across the country. And it really worries me. It's because it reminds me of the issue about responsible gun legislation, which is something that a huge majority of Americans support. A huge majority of Americans and Arizonans support access to reproductive health care. And to see rulings like this that are so extreme, no exceptions for rape or incest, it is so out of touch with what people of all parties want.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very disturbing and very upsetting. And I am hopeful that we will find our way forward. I know there are many passionate, talented people working on that. We certainly have our abortion initiative coming up that will be on our ballot in November. But yeah, it's... Our attorney general called the bill draconian, and I have to agree.
Yeah, like I can't really think of any other positive or any other rules from the Civil War that we would be happy to bring back today. Like you get rid of them for a reason.
Women couldn't even vote
We couldn't even wear pants, like not even vote, but like we couldn't wear pants.
Right. Doctors didn't even know that they should wash their hands. It's unreal.
Have you read anything about the author of the ban originally?
I have not.
Okay. So just this is a side note, listeners, but he's super creepy perv. Like he abandons his first wife and child and then marries a 12-year-old for his second wife. And then his third wife, because he will leave her eventually, his third wife is 15. And his Wikipedia describes him as a pursuer of nubile females, which is a pretty creepy thing to include in Wikipedia, but it's like it's such a dominant trend for him that it makes it into the opening paragraph.
And good thing that guy is deciding laws for, you know, the millions of people in this state. It's like the headline dog catches car, right? My colleagues across the aisle have been pushing for this. Many of them voted for the 2022 bill or the 15-week ban that sort of paved the way for this. And now that it's happened, they're backtracking. I don't know, this is too far. And on the one hand, I'm happy that they are recognizing that because I hope it will build a coalition of people who, again, support reproductive health care. But it's also very frustrating. And this is what you wanted. Mm-hmm. This is what did you think would happen when Roe fell?
Mm-hmm.
And so in so many ways, it's too little too late. And I believe those politicians that their voters will hold them accountable at the ballot box in November.
Yeah. Carrie Lake is a local example, right? Mm-hmm. She's on record praising this bill this rule is a good rule and is now saying it goes too far and that she's calling on the governor to find a solution for all people.
Oh, well, I'm happy she's finally recognized that Governor Hobbs is indeed our duly elected governor. So that's a positive. But Donald Trump as well.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. And it's very disappointing.
I am optimistic, however, because, and perhaps naively, but I think that you've seen in state after state, there is overwhelming support for women's reproductive rights. I was very upset when Roe fell. I'm very scared, honestly. And I think that even when you have every county in Kansas who's not a beacon of progressive values coming out to defend a woman's right to choose, I think that makes me cautiously optimistic that it can be pushed back in Arizona.
Yeah. And one thing that I want people to know, particularly in Arizona, we do have the abortion initiative, but citizen initiatives have had a rough go of it here in the last several years. We fully expect that it will be challenged in court. And so if people, if this is something you're passionate about, I would encourage you to donate to that effort because we do expect this to go to litigation. And the same Arizona Supreme Court that just instituted this Civil War era ban will potentially hear that as well. So we need to make sure that in addition to supporting the abortion initiative, we are researching candidates and voting our values, voting for people who support this access.
Particularly the attorney general, right? Because if I recall, she won her race by 200 votes.
280 votes. Landslide Mays, we call her.
Yeah.
And I am grateful every single day that she, along with Secretary Fontes and Governor Hobbs, are leading our state.
So the final thing that I want to get into with you is your decision not to run for reelection. What motivated that? There's been a lot of press around you as a rising star. And when I hear you talk about it, you sound really passionate about the work you're doing. So I'm curious why you're not going to run again.
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult decision. It was a heartbreaking decision. And just like the decision to run for office is guided by any number of things, the decision to not run for office is guided by a number of things. This was a complicated decision. A lot went into it. Some of the things that I do want to highlight is pay. This decision, the financial considerations had a lot to do with this. My situation changed a lot between 22 and 24. And in Arizona, lawmakers make $24,000 a year. So I have three jobs, the legislature, I have my work with a nonprofit, and then I substitute teach to make ends meet. Cost of living is high in my district. I had to sell my house at a loss in February, and I had to liquidate savings just to be able to stay in my district. And I was very concerned, knowing how much work it is to win in a purple, I was very concerned that because of how much I was needing to work just to keep myself afloat, that I wouldn't be able to put in that time and effort. And one of the beautiful things about my district is that there are so many talented, wonderful people there. And we have two incredible women running for the state house now in Karen Gresham and Kelly Butler. And I'm so excited to support them both. And this was a hard decision. And then on a personal note, you find all kinds of things at the legislature, and something that I was not expecting to find there was love. My partner is also, he's a now former state house representative. And so what I joked to people is, I said, we've been legally prohibited from living together up until this point because we represented different districts. So it's tough, it's heartbreaking, but the silver lining is that I can take the next steps forward in my personal journey. And I am confident I do have my next steps laid out, although there's a little bit of a ways to go with that. But I will continue to be of service to the state, albeit no longer in an elected capacity. And I hope one day that we can pay our lawmakers more and that it becomes an easier environment to work in, because that's certainly part of it too. And I also think, you know, for any elected official, people very often forget that we are real people. Mm-hmm. And the level of kind of communication and support and respect that you depend on, I mean, it has to be there. And just, yeah, that recognition that, you know, I go to the grocery store, I see my friends, I, you know, have things that I care about that are not politics. I mean, we are real people. And if I may also highlight some of the, it is just such a difficult environment in Arizona right now. I've certainly had the death threats. I had someone at my house in the middle of the night multiple times. We had a police detail on our campaign for some time. There was a video threatening with an AR-15. And we've seen that people have been imprisoned for their threats against County Recorder Richer. And Supervisor Bill Gates has spoken quite openly about the after effects of everything he's gone through for certifying the 2020 and 22 elections, rightly so. Just recognizing that you can vehemently disagree with people, but they're still human beings, and that, you know, that type of behavior hurts us all.
I think that the economic realities are something that voters should really think carefully about, because there are more working class people than millionaires or billionaires, obviously. But it's, if running for office becomes prohibitive for everybody except those that are in like this more affluent class, then the majority loses representation, at least like through an economic lens. And I think that is how you get laws that favor one group over the other, is when you don't have a voice that's at the table. So I think it's something that listeners should consider really closely in their own communities. Mm-hmm. And as far as the death threats go, how seriously do you take these threats? And can you just brush them off? Or is that naive? Or,
and how do we find our way through that as an electorate, as a country? That's something I think about, and it is really hard. And then I wanted to circle back to what you said about the pay. So if we were to raise pay in Arizona, that would have to go out to the voters. And people don't have positive feelings all the time about mm-hmm. politicians right now. So I don't know how well that would go over. But I was talking with someone the other day, and they were saying, this is an elected, and they're saying, I along with my spouse, and we make $400,000 a year, and that's really not that much. And I was just thinking, no, it is.
Yeah, it's actually a great deal.
It's a lot. And I make nowhere close to that. And for working folks, you deserve a voice at the legislature to bring all kinds of perspectives. And yeah, it's sad, it's difficult, but I'm hopeful and optimistic about my next steps. And again, I will continue to be in service to the state and involved. And you never know what's in the future. So.
And listeners, I will say that Laura's refused to tell us what those next steps are, either on or off the record. But one thing that I will ask you is your next step political?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess we'll all just be Googling and conspiracy theorizing about what that next step would be. But Laura, thank you so much for your time and for being a guest on the show. I really loved this conversation. And I hope that whenever you announce whatever this next step is, that you will come back and talk to us.
Oh, I would love to. It's been an absolute pleasure. And yes, in all things moderation, right?
Except women's reproductive choice.
Absolutely.
Yes. All right, guys, thanks for listening. Laura's journey from a dedicated educator to a force for change in the legislative arena was truly inspiring. And it reminds all of us of the profound impact public service and advocacy can have. Laura's commitment to education, early childhood development, and the pursuit of a bipartisan solution to key issues underscores the potential that we all possess to promote understanding and advancement in our communities. One of the issues facing moderates everywhere is that we're too quiet. So take a note from Laura's book and get a little bit louder. I also want to extend one final thank you to the New Deal Forum for hosting a great event in Phoenix. I had a great time, and it really encouraged me to see so many leaders coming together to make meaningful change in their communities. To learn more about them and their work, head over to thenewdealforum.org, and to learn more about the New Deal leaders, head over to newdealleaders.org. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, I want to invite you to leave a review, follow the show, and rate it on your preferred podcast platform. Doing that helps us spread the word about the show and continue to bring meaningful conversations and insight. And don't forget, if you have thoughts or suggestions, you can always email them to me at talk@moderatepartypodcast.com or follow us on Instagram at @moderatepartypod or Twitter, X. I don't know what we're calling it, but look us up. We're there. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon. Stay safe, guys.